Good afternoon or good morning to those of you in the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Laura Feast and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is credit crunch and impacts on freight transportation. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presentations, the first given by Noel Perry of Transport Fundamentals, the second presentation will be given by Greg Arnold of Prologis, and the final presentation will be given by John Gray of the Association of American Railroads. Noel Perry, before founding the Transport Fundamentals, Noel served for 30 years in senior research positions at Schneider National, Cummins Engine Company, and CSX. He now continues his strategic work on customer logistics, economics, North American transportation demand, carrier competition, and groundbreaking research on truck driver supply and demand. He is a member of the Transportation Research Board, Transportation Research Forum, the National Business Economists Issues Council, and the Council of Logistics Management. Greg Arnold is a Senior Vice President, Director of the Global Corporate Services Group, where he has responsibilities for Prologis' global customers in North America. Prior to, Mr. Arnold was Director of Global Services Group. He was the Vice President with Global Services with account responsibility for the Northeast region of North America. Mr. Arnold joined Prologis in 1995 and is located in New Jersey. John Gray is a Senior Vice President of Policy and Economics for the Association of American Railroads. He assumed this role in 2008. His responsibilities include the collection, analysis, and presentation of economic data related to railroads and their economic environment, as well as development of policy positions on current significant rail issues. His principal duties are conducting and supervising economic, financial, statistical, and cost studies dealing with various aspects of the rail industry. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting today's seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers, and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the lower right side of your screen. Please make sure you are typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during the presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and is a great forum for the distribution of information and a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you've not already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I would like to remind you that this session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and visual portion of this seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may not have been able to attend this seminar to access the recorded seminar. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next week. I will notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and the transcript of this seminar. We're now going to go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is credit crunch and impacts on freight transportation. Our first presentation will be given by Noel Perry of Transport Fundamentals. And you'll have to excuse the typo on the front slide. I will send out correct information with the follow-up for getting in touch with Noel. The second presentation will be given by Greg Arnold of Prologis, and the final presentation will be given by John Gray of the Association of American Railroads. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentations, please type them into the chat box, and they will be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. With that, I will go ahead and give it over to Noel. I'll bring up your presentation.
Thank you, Laura. I'll get started. I'm going to move through these slides pretty quickly. I've got more than my time allows, but I will slow down on the several that warrant full discussion. So let's get started. I'm going to talk mainly about the interaction between the economy and the transportation industry right now to help you all understand the magnitude and length, both depth and length, rather, of this event and what effect it's had on the industry. This is the big one, the biggest probably since 1933. All this first slide points out is that when, for trucking and rail, by the way, the pain of a recession is not limited to the time when GDP is actually falling, which is the red area in this particular slide. When GDP falls below 3% growth, approximately, which it first did back in 2005, as you can see, and we don't expect it to get above 3% until well into 2010. When it's below 3%, neither rail freight nor truck freight grows. So a recession for the transportation industry is much longer than the Census Bureau's definition of recession. So instead of this being a four-quarter recession, which the government has defined it as so far, this is a 14-quarter deal, actually 15 now. So there's an issue about cumulative stress on the industry. People who have had just enough cash the last two or three years are starting to run into real problems. And my friends in the security analyst industry tell me that right now the only thing that is preventing a horde of bankruptcies is that the creditors would rather not try to resell a bunch of old equipment, since I'll show you later there's a huge surplus of that. So there's a bunch of guys running who should be bankrupt but have been forgiven by their creditors. And that portion of the industry which is hurting the most is usually, in a downturn, concentrated amongst the small fleets. They are the swing capacity in the industry. You can see this registration data shows that the share of registrations by small fleets always falls in a downturn, and that's certainly the case this time. Now here's how I measure this recession. The vertical axis here is peak to trough depth, and the horizontal axis is length in quarters, and what I've done here is to show in relative size the freight recessions we've had since 1982. Notice the 82 event, which started in late 79, was a little deeper and so far a little longer. So even though the economy wasn't quite as bad that time around, freight has experienced one of these things, certainly in my working time. However, compared to the last two recessions, the one of 01 and the one in 1990, this one is many times bigger. So this one hurts, and you should expect quite a bit of pain and withdrawal from the industry amongst the carriers in your neighborhood. When you get that kind of freight drop, you get dramatic drops in truck utilization. This one may be even a little bit worse than 82, given the fact that we entered this event with a surplus because of the 07 engine pre-buy. You can see we're down now around 76% of trucks that are owned in full use, and we like to be at 90% or greater, certainly for good profitability. So this is a very difficult thing for the industry. And when margins get down to 76%, you get into the neighborhood of somewhere between minimally sustainable margins, 2%, to below zero margins, which can last for 6 to 9 months. My best guess right now is we're somewhere just below zero. This is the worst time in this recession right now. And if you're in the manufacturing business supporting the industry, it follows that orders dry up. We are now in our, what, 5 or 6 consecutive months when orders have been below replacement. And orders have never been below replacement before in my partners at FTR Associates database. So the industry is starting to pay out capacity. Notice, however, though, that sales didn't drop below replacement until this year. So even though there was quite a bit of stress in the industry in 06, 07, and 08, the industry was actually still adding capacity. That makes it harder now. It's important to think about what happens next, and what happens next is not usually recovery. It's what I call bottom, where the industry, where the economy bumps along at very low growth rates, and of course, that means for transportation, no recovery until the acceleration, which is later. It's better than falling. Trucks can, truck fleets, as an example, can rationalize their routes under these circumstances because demand is stable, but it certainly isn't growth. We are pretty sure we have a bottom because if you look at the all the indicators that people publish about the economy, whereas 3 months ago they were almost all negative, you can see on this chart by direction, now most of them are up or flat. So that's a good thing, but it does not imply strong recovery yet. Bottoms last somewhere between 3 and 6 quarters, and GDP grows between 0 and 2%. Many politicians will, of course, declare victory if we get 2% growth, but for the trucking and railroad industries, that's still a recession. When will it start and how strong? Well, it's likely to start early next year, and there are two strong scenarios to consider. One of them is that the data on banking failures in large economies, all of which outside of the United States, because we haven't had a banking failure since 33, the data says that banking failure recoveries are slow to recover. They're also a little longer than normal. And if you look at this data, we're already, if you look at the left-hand side on the recession length, we are already equal to what a banking failure recession ought to be. And the time to the next, to equal the previous peak, the standard forecast, which I have in red, says 6 quarters, and this one, the average of all outside economies is 5. So in that regard, the forecast that most people are talking about are consistent with the banking failure recovery. Where they're not consistent is the growth rates. This recession it's actually a little deeper. If you look at recession depth, it's 3.8% versus 3.5% for the average. But if you look at growth, the growth under a banking failure would be 0.5% less the first year almost 1% less the second year. And what's significant to the transportation industry is that first year really doesn't matter much because they're all below 3. But the second year, the conventional forecast that most people are saying would start substantial growth in transportation, but if it stays below 3, as indicated by the banking failure data, we would get another year of recession. And I plotted that in terms of capacity utilization and surplus, and you can see that we would not, even at the end of 2011, capacity utilization would be barely just above 80%, and we still have a surplus of 120,000 vehicles. So a banking failure recovery would have substantial negative impact on transportation. Now, the other way to look at this, however, is to look at the history a little differently. And in the United States, putting aside that banking failure data for a moment, in every recession we've had since 1949, we've had, with the exception of 01, pretty substantial growth in the next year. And 01 is a pretty good exception because we didn't really have a recession anymore. But you can see, on average, the economies grew by 5% in the first year after the recession, which would make 2010 a pretty good year. So this says maybe that pessimism is not justified. So what I have done is to compare this recovery with the 82 recovery, which was a 83 recovery, which was after a recession a lot like this one. And one of the things that comes out of that is, even though that was not called a banking failure recession, there was a radical worsening in lending conditions from the previous peak, and you can see it here in green, to the recovery period. Even though the recovery shows real interest rates around 20%, down about 10% from the peak, they were still way above what they were at the beginning of the period in the previous peak. So that economy recovered despite the fact that it still had big financial drag. These rates, by the way, here include high-risk borrowers. Now, this time, the data is quite similar. It got worse in the trough. That's why we had the banking failure. But it looks like real interest rates, even for the bad borrowers, will be a little lower than they were last time. And remember, last time the economy recovered anyway. This chart here shows corporate profits in a couple different terms, and what's important to note, and you see it in the 2 hours at the right, that profits are quite a bit higher, even at the bottom of this recession, than they were in '83. So there's corporate money to fund capital investment this time when there was not last time. Finally, and this was a surprise to me, and even those of you in the public sector might not find this surprising, last time, now there was a very substantial federal stimulus to the economy, almost as big as this one. You can see the data here shows that. Last time it was mainly in tax relief, this time it's mainly in spending, but the fact is the federal government really stimulated the economy in both cases. Now, if this happens, look what happens in the trucking business. We get back to equilibrium in terms of surplus late in 2010 rather than late in 2011. So the banking failure case really means a whole year reduction, extension of the recession. Even if, however, we get a good, strong recovery, note that freight will not get back to its previous peak in 06 until sometime in 2013. So this was a pretty bad deal. And from a capacity standpoint, road capacity, parking capacity, truck capacity, we're not going to get the pushing those levels of capacity for another 4 years. And also, here's an estimate that my partners at FDR do that shows the overhang of used trucks. And you can see that we're in the neighborhood of 110,000 right now. And this is over above normal, we won't run that down for another 2 years. Now, a couple of other comments, longer-term trends, and then I'll quit. First off, a lot of people are interested in the driver problem, and historically, the driver problem is a very simple one. Prior to the mid-90s, the steady increase in productivity meant that the amount of people, as I've shown in this example, if the work had been growing at 3%, because productivity was growing at 2%, the number of drivers only had to grow 1%, because each year drivers could do more. And that was about equal to the growth in the labor pool. And so the industry through the mid-90s was in rough equilibrium. What's happened since is because our society has decided not to build any more roads and not to allow truckers to increase their load size for good or bad. They've changed that policy. Now productivity is not rising, it's falling. And so, even though the growth in ton miles is now 2.5% on trend, because productivity is falling, it requires more than 2.5% growth in drivers, not the 1% we had before. So you can see, if you look at the labor pool then, that we have a deficit, a substantial deficit of a demographic deficit. And that deficit's only going to get worse. What I've done here is to show the effect of retirements and labor force growth. Red is retirements were actually a positive in 96 to 06 because the baby boomers hadn't started to retire yet. Well, the next 10 years, me included, retirements will now be a net reduction in the workforce. At the same time, the labor force is growing on its own, slightly smaller. Finally, some comments about the green initiatives. It is clear on a line haul basis, running in long distances with relatively simple operations, that railroads have a pretty substantial advantage over trucks with respect to both fuel consumed and the amount of carbon produced. And I've shown my estimates of those numbers here. These are pretty consistent with, well, I think, what the AAR shows. However, to get to the fully rich public policy questions, you have to say, well, but what are we measuring here? And if you measure it door to door, or happens to be drive-in, which is less advantageous to rail than the bulk stuff. But if you're going door to door, and if you factor in inventory effects, when you waste inventory, you waste the fuel that was burnt to make the inventory. Truck now is not inferior to rail; it's equal to, and compared to carload, which has some substantial inventory problems, it's superior. So it's really important in making decisions about modal share to consider what you're trying to do. If you're trying to get coal from Wyoming to Georgia, by all means, you want to favor rail. But if you're trying to get toys from Philadelphia to a D.C. and southeastern Ohio, truck is a fairly virtuous way to do it. And finally, when you talk about emissions, greenhouse gases particularly, it's important to recognize that as yet the railroads are largely unregulated in a very critical gas, and that is NOx. It turns out that NOx is a bigger contributor to greenhouse gases than carbon. I don't know the science, but I know that the EPA tells us that a equal volume of NOx produces 305 times the equal volume, the same volume of carbon. So in order to understand who's more clean, at least in today's technology, you have to factor in the fact that trucks are highly tightly regulated and railroads are hardly regulated at all. And when you do that, it turns out that trucks, at least properly maintained trucks, are substantially cleaner with respect to greenhouse gases than railroads right now, because railroads are largely unregulated. That is changing, and by 2015, the railroads will be much more tightly regulated. The Congress, however, as yet, is not planning to require the railroads to be as clean with NOx as truckers are. So even with the 2015 improvements, truck will still be slightly cleaner than rail, because the truck standard for emissions, even in 2015, is substantially lower than for rail. One final point about modal share, and what I'd like you to remember here is the marketplace has spent the last 50 years figuring out what each of the many modes do well. And modal share hasn't changed much, and it's unlikely to unless there is some radical change in economics or maybe regulation. what this chart shows, the most sensitive of the modal share swings is domestic intermodal, which is directly competitive with truck. And you can see in the blue line that the share hasn't changed much over the years. It tends to bounce up and down. And even when fuel was rising through 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, it did not respond. When fuel spiked in 2008, there was perhaps a change. Customers were looking for a way to save money. But then when fuel fell again, the share fell. So what I'd like you to remember is that the marketplace has been quite efficient in figuring out what each one of these modes do. And each has a very strong place in our economy. But there's no economic evidence that the government should attempt to change those based on either cost, fuel, or green initiatives. So that's what I have to say today. I'll be glad to answer questions when it's appropriate.
Great. Thank you, Noel, and thank you for those of you that have posted questions. We will address your questions at the end of the seminar. We will now move on to Greg Arnold of Prologis. So, Greg, let me just get your presentation all set up here, and then you're good to go.
Okay. I have a little bit different presentation for you today. One, a warehouse developer, and one, Prologis, with a leading developer of warehouses throughout the world. We've got a little bit more than 475 million square feet of industrial space in Asia, Europe, and North America. But what I want to bring up is warehousing demand is directly tied to consumer consumption. And the stronger the economy, the inventories increase. And as inventories increase, that's freight movement, because at one point of the supply chain or another, these products are in a warehouse. So I won't go into a lot of economics. I think Noel covered it very adequately, and I will reaffirm some of the statements in my presentation. Just a little bit highlighting on that. We've got 10.5 million feet in Asia, 350 million feet in North America, and 128 million feet in Europe, and that's about 3,000 buildings. I think it's very important that the point and the way my presentation is set up is, let's take the comparison to the past recessions. You know, today it's been said that the recession we're experiencing started in 2007, and we felt the impact of it, and virtually the economy stopped in October of 2008. Today, there's virtually no development of industrial warehouses across the United States. We recently went through a review of the markets, of the 55 markets in North America. We believe there were 5 build-to-suits going on at that time. Now, if you compare it, I can't give you a projection of when we're going out. I think Noel did a better job than I could ever come close to. But we will compare it back to the recession of 89, when the SNL challenges. And that was when the warehouse demand stopped in 89 and then actually started picking back up in 2004. And in Noel's presentation, it highlighted that. So we look at it as a 5-year term. So if this recession is any worse than the last one went through in 88, 89, to 5 years, it could go longer. Okay, I'm gonna cover world trade though. I think a couple of things that we'll see, and I'll talk about trends in the supply chain, what will it do for freight transportation, is where we'll be building our next distribution facilities. And I'll, again, I'm gonna highlight up to 2007 as a date, because everything really stopped, and that was the start of the recession. World GDP grew from 1988 to 2007, a little over 200%. But I think the most important thing you should note is from 1988 to 2007, world trade increased over 470%. Now, what's important there? World growth GDP is the production of a country. World trade is the inner trade between those countries. Now, today, with the supply chains as flexible as they are, people are sourcing in different locations. Back to 1988 time frame, they might be only sourcing in the Western Hemisphere. But now we're looking at people looking at the product coming from China, Vietnam, Malaysia, South America, and looking for the lowest landed cost in the United States. That will change constantly, so we want more flexibility in supply chain. So the world trade is increasing significantly. Just a point to note, in 2001, when it was admitted to the WTO, look at the increase in the sale, purchasing power of the United States of what we bought from China, a big indicator of that world trade. Now, when we talk about transportation, or I'm going to talk about supply chain trends, we talk about either airports or seaports. And I'm using this as 2006 was the highest volume of activity. We have 2.9 billion metric tons moved through seaports, and only 0.072 billion metric tons to airports. Your high dollar value product goes to the airports. Your high bulk product goes to seaports. So 97% of the world's cargo goes through a seaport. Now, that's what I'll focus on port growth for you here. And in 1996, okay, back to where looking at seaport growth and the start of real globalization of the supply chain, we had 68 million TEUs. Now, TEU is 20 equivalent units. That's a container 20 feet long. Typical containers that we're seeing today are 40 feet long, so that's two TEUs. But now we look at, in 2007, 211 million TEUs moved. That is a significant, look at the difference, we had 450% growth in world trade, and look at the, we had 400% growth in TEUs moved from ports. In 1996, there's an indicator of where the top ports were throughout the world. Look at this dispersion with the countries from the ports. Hong Kong and Singapore typically lead, as many know, those are hubs in Asia and South Pacific, where all the containers go in and put on another ship to head over. And LA Long Beach is sitting at three. But again, we see several Japan locations here, and that was 1996. 2007, of the top 15, seven are China. Now, this again is, look at the TEU growth between 2006 and 2007. There was still growth when we started looking at when the recession hit in 2007. Why is that important? And one of the things I'm going to use today is the cost of the product to the consumer, and the lowest landed cost is what is important to our manufacturers and distributors. And the time is money. So from Shanghai, transit times to the West Coast roughly are 13 days. And then moving that product across to the mainland or the East Coast of the United States, and these are average days, are either from 5 days to 8 days. Now, the ports of the West Coast have the depth and have the ease of connection, and we've had some expansion on that side. Now, we've been talking about port dispersion. How long does it take to get to the East Coast? And the East Coast is 28 days to Houston, up to 26 days to Newark. Now, the important thing to note here is, more times you touch a product means more cost goes into that product. So if we can stay on the ship to get to the East Coast, that can be a more economic value for a shipper. Today, that's been equalized a little bit by the rail, and they've been equalizing the rates from the long hauls going across from L.A. Long Beach, or you see from Vancouver down to Toronto. But as we also highlight here, the Dallas, Chicago, Toronto, those are inland ports today where the product is being imported. We've got a couple new ports coming in where a product will be alternate choices. Prince Rupert up in Canada, and bringing it down to Toronto to come into the United States. And here's some important things I'd like to highlight to you. L.A. Long Beach, that is the largest warehouse market in North America. There's roughly 1 billion square feet of warehousing in that market. And Chicago is the second largest market in North America. And as you can see, that is really another inland port for us because it's the heartland of the United States. And that's roughly about 800 million square feet. Toronto is the third largest market for warehousing in North America, and New Jersey, Eastern Pennsylvania is the fourth. North America port activity is highlighted here is that LA Long Beach, 15.6 million TEUs in 2007. Look at it, it's three times larger than the Newark port. And you can see how it compares down to the East Coast ports lower on the list. I think that's important for trends in the future. North American container market share. We can see 55%, 0.9% was in going to the West Coast, and in 2006 that dropped a little bit in 2007, and then we had a real significant drop off in 2008. But I think what's important to note here is the fact that there's an increase on port dispersion, moving product to the East Coast or the Gulf areas, in light of being on the West Coast. More information about transportation across the U.S. or in intermodal transportation, 55% to bring it to the East Coast route. Through the Panama Canal went up to 43%, and across the Suez, which is a very long distance, is only about 2%. Now, here's a little point of the Panama Canal update. As you know, it was initially started by the French. The United States stepped in early 1900s to complete the canal. It runs about 14,000 ships a year. The capacity of the canal is only good for 5,000 TEU ships. And basically today we have ships being built at over 10,000 TEUs. Recently, we know that the Panama has taken on a tremendous project to expand the canal, and it's expected to be completed in 2014. That will help the secondary ports of the Gulf Coast and the East Coast for traffic. Here's a little comparison. The current canal lock dimensions are 1,000 by 110. So you can see from a Panamax ship to post-Panamax ship, that warp pilot limitation. Now, when you look at a post-Suez ship, that would be like the Amamaris, which is the largest ship in the world. This is about 14,000 TEUs. But we're going to be able to increase the number of TEUs through the Panama Canal and doubling that volume. How does it impact North America? Again, I want to go back to some important points. One, when you look at the cost of sales of logistics, it's roughly 8.8%. And the major component of the logistics cost is your transportation. That's your freight transportation. A point and a half is only the warehousing, and that includes the labor component of that. But the rent of a building is less than half a percent here. Therefore, many times you could say, let's build a cheap building in an outlying location, and we can bring transport and we can bring a company into our community. That's really not the case. It's the transportation drives the location. Oops, the wrong button. I'm sorry. When you talk about dispersion through the United States and where you're going to locate warehouses, it really goes to the U.S. population. And the population within, this is indicating the major metropolitan markets and their percentage of the population within 500 miles. 500 miles being an average day of a truck's run. So as you can see, Columbus, Ohio has the highest percentage of the population at 48%. But take a look, as we know, we've got over 67% of the population on the East Coast, east of the Mississippi. When we talk about warehouse locations, which is where trucks and freight move back and forth to, if you pick the 10 best locations, I'll start from the first. If you had one warehouse, you'd put it in the middle of Indiana. And two, you'd put it basically in the northern Kentucky and then L.A. And three, and I'll move through this quickly. But just to give you an idea, it matches the population densities of the United States and focusing toward the East Coast. Today, major retailers have focused their import centers and their growth to the ports. And today, I've highlighted where Walmart's put their locations in Houston. I didn't indicate the major 3 to 4 million square foot project they put into Chicago. You have Target, you have Home Depot, these are major importers. So you notice, look at the attention to the East Coast for the imports and their locations. What are the driving factors today? Okay, let me step back to a couple things. One, if we take a look at what the recession was from 1980 and 89, it didn't see a recovery to 2004. We think that we compare that to today, that we could be going into potentially 2014 as a recovery or future demand for warehouse growth. So the key metrics for top markets in the future would be, one, proximity to local population basis, which I tried to demonstrate. Two, the capacity of the port and location of the port. Most importantly, the good road infrastructure and inland ports, such as New Kansas City is doing a significant project with the Kansas City Southern, and I think the gentleman following will talk a little bit about the rail activity. For exports, it would be more proximity to diverse marketing manufacturing centers and how close to the port. It's always obvious that cost of labor, degree of union activity, and the risk of labor strikes will determine the use of those ports and the frequency and availability of the dedicated liner service. And we noted that certain services today have initiated in Mobile. They've invested heavily in the Port of Norfolk just to the East Coast. So as a futures trend, how do we see it? We see warehousing moving closer into the inland ports, such as the Chicago, Dallas, Memphis, Toronto, major metropolitan markets. Reason being the intermodal costs, the drayage costs, and railroad service. We're going to see increased flexibility of supply chains, and that's most importantly the diversified port strategy. That is going to be totally determined by that sourcing aspect. You could be sourcing in China today, but it, as flexible as the supply chains are and how quick they change, you could be seeing sourcing come out of South America in the short future. We're seeing some manufacturing move back from China to Mexico. We've seen increased demand in our facilities in Mexico right now. But the important point of supply chains will be continually changing throughout as we grow back back to the activity level of 2006. Right now, people are looking at network adjustments. What do I do with my warehouses? Do I put them closer to, do they take more and put closer to population bases? Or do I add deconsolidation centers as part of my network? A deconsolidation center is a terminal where you bring in the container and move those over to either the truck or rail. And we see that as being the big activity for the future, and as well as the new development being more on the East Coast as the Panama Canal opens in 2014. I've tried to be brief and quick through my presentation, so I'll look forward to answering your questions at the very end. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Our final presentation will be given by John Gray of the Association of American Railroads. Let me just bring up your presentation for you, and then you should be good to go.
Thank you, Laura. It's an interesting time to be talking about some of these issues. It's one when we're seeing a lot of change, a lot of issues evolving in the industry, as well as having to deal with the economy. What I'd like to do as we go forward here today is point out some of the mega issues that we are dealing with right now, and then focus down on the economy and where we have come from on that, and some comments on where some of the changes look like they may occur in the future as we go forward with the some of the business lines that we're involved in. If you look at the industry today, just to give you a quick overview, the vast majority of the industry is made up of the seven large, two in the east, two in the west, two Canadian carriers, and a smaller Midwestern carrier, Kansas City Southern, that also has major operations in Mexico. So it's those seven carriers basically make up the about 90%+ of the railroad business, at least in terms of the employees and the freight that's out there. There are a large number of smaller carriers operating in either local or regional areas that have a substantial amount of the mileage, but generate far less in terms of total freight traffic. the issues that the industry is looking at today, and ones that we think are the big deal items that are on the horizon for 2009, is one that is a perennial favorite in our business, as has been ever since the industry was partially deregulated in 1980. Is preserving the regulatory structure that allows us to generate the capital necessary to support the industry and generate the returns necessary from that capital that can provide the very high cost of infrastructure that we have to support. A newcomer to the list, but one which could be a major item for the rail industry going forward, is the climate change and the potential climate change legislation, both impacts and opportunities. The impacts being that one of our major commodities handled is coal, which clearly is under attack in the desire to reduce greenhouse gases produced by coal-burning utilities. The opportunities being in potential growth within some of our intermodal business related to both fuel efficiency and greenhouse gas production issues. Third item that has emerged during the last year or so is the development and installation of positive train control systems mandated by Congress late last year. An unfunded mandate of between $5 and $7 billion for the industry, for technology that is, quite frankly, still at least partially in developmental stages. Another item that is again both a challenge and a potential opportunity is the renewed interest, or the new interest, in high-speed rail for the industry. $8 billion appropriated by Congress during the stimulus package for high-speed rail. The challenges for us are that high speed can be very disruptive to freight operations, and the opportunities, of course, are that there may be opportunities for improving physical plant for both freight and passenger operations if these funds are in some cases properly coordinated. An item that is a perennial problem for our industry: moving highly hazardous materials. We are required by law to move highly hazardous materials whether we want to or not. We are not allowed to charge for moving those materials other than normal freight rates, but the liability from them is huge, potentially disastrous liability for the industry. But the big guy out there, and the one that I want to spend most of the time on today, is the economy. Now, if you look at the rail system in the U.S., we have our traffic movement and our business levels have closely followed GDP for many years. If you sent this line back another couple decades, you'd see the same kind of relationship out there. Quite frankly, the little diversion that we have up here at the top for 2007-2008 is one of the biggest diversions that we've had in traffic versus GDP in some time. In effect, it confirms that we were starting to see a lot of the impact of some of the recession issues as far back as late 2006, and I'll show you some of those a few charts down the way. Now, why do we act with the GDP? One of the reasons is a lot of the things that we handle tend to move with the economy, as you might expect. The two largest items that we move are coal and then the intermodal business, both being about 20% of our business portfolio. And then a large number of carload and bulk items, some for various parts of the economy, both food production, construction, and production of consumer goods along the way, as well as consumer goods including automobiles in this case. So, to give you a little background on how we got here, beginning in 2003, there were a lot of factors out there in the economy, not just the U.S. economy, but worldwide, that were pushing freight towards the rail industry. And one of these was GDP growth, but another was the growth in export markets for U.S. goods. We've shown it here as grain, but it was far greater than grain. Included things such as fertilizers, coal, a whole group of manufactured goods, machinery, all kinds of U.S. goods that were heavily involved in the export market. Growth in electricity consumption from coal, the rail hauled coal accounts for a very, very large portion of the electricity that was produced in the United States. And so as electricity production and demand boomed in the last decade, the coal required to handle that has also grown. In addition to that, there was the growth in congestion on the highway system, which for a number of trucking companies made their cost such that they came to prefer intermodal rail for movement of a lot of their goods, as well as the growth in international traffic, which international consumer traffic, which also provided a very, very large growth opportunity for the intermodal business. Bottom line is it meant a lot more rail traffic, up about 12% in the last decade. Resulted in tighter capacity for the rail system, that the capacity index grew by about 30%, substantially more business per mile of railroad. And with that tightening of capacity, the freight rates that have been falling since about 1980 started to increase with the increases in demand. Really the first meaningful increases that we've seen during that 25-year period, so that you did have healthier pricing for the transportation service. Net result, more traffic, higher rates equals higher revenue, something that's improved dramatically for the industry between 2003-2008. But what do you do with that? Well, since that improves the net income, it has also given the industry the opportunity to dramatically increase its capital spending. In fact, the capital spending, mostly for infrastructure projects, has almost doubled in the last decade in the rail industry, largely because the income was there to provide that. Capital spending has, in fact, gotten up to the level where on the four largest railroads, you're seeing the spending levels roughly equivalent to the larger state spending programs that are going on. But as with all good things, this had to come to an end. Now, keep in mind that the rail industry and in fact, all transportation of freight is a derived demand industry. And that demand is driven mostly by consumption in the economy. GDP made up the biggest component of it by far in consumption. The other component that affects the rail industry to some extent is government spending, mostly for government construction projects. And then, of course, the export-import balance, even that had some impact for us because of the amount of import traffic that was going on, as well as export opportunities. Well, where are we today? Because fewer people that are working out there, you've seen an economy that was producing lots of jobs, turned negative, giving us a lot fewer jobs, in fact, back to 2004 levels. in those jobs. Unemployment increasing, net result of that, consumer confidence dropping rapidly, and retail sales after peaking in 2008, dropping by about $40 billion per month to 2009 levels. Keep in mind that this $40 billion reduction in retail sales represents about almost a half trillion dollars a year in reduction. Half trillion dollars a year, with the logistics component being roughly 10% of that, gives you a reduction in almost $50 billion in spending related to the logistics business. Which, as you recall, is about the equivalent of the entire rail revenue stream for 2008. So it's a big number that has come out of the economy. Now, since rail intermodal is heavily focused on consumer goods, much of it, again, for large retailers, it has been an area that's been particularly heavily impacted for us. As you can see here, the 2009 data, and in fact late 2008, indicates that the intermodal business, both domestic and international business, has dropped to levels that would be equivalent to roughly the lowest month of most years. December is traditionally the lowest month of intermodal business. 2009 is pretty much running at December levels, as you can see, at or below what have been December levels in the past. So it is a fairly grim picture for what we're seeing for movement for the intermodal business. Another area that is really a bellwether for both our business and the economy as a whole is our lumber and wood products business. If you look at this, you realize that you were starting to see serious declines in the carload business for lumber as far back as 2006. If you've been around this industry very long, you realize very quickly, or we did by the end of 2006, that something really bad was going to happen. We didn't know how bad, and we didn't know when, but we knew that you only see patterns like this at the beginning of recessions, and you only see these patterns. Patterns this extreme in a recession that is going to be fairly serious. It confirms what was said earlier, that you're starting to see some of the effects of the recession as far back as 2006, 2007, that you really didn't have to wait until the official beginning of the recession, early 2008, to appreciate some of the impact of that was going on. Another area that was where there was serious impact was in automobile sales and auto parts, as well as the suppliers for the automobile industry, such as the steel industry, plastics industry, glass industry, a variety of folks like this. The thing that we're seeing about the auto industry, though, is for railroads, kind of a double effect, because as our car loadings have declined, and they've declined more sharply than automotive movement as a whole. The reality on it is that back in 2005 and 2006, the carloads back then were very heavily weighted towards the movement of light trucks, SUVs, and pickups. That was a big part of the movement. Now, these are large vehicles that only load 8 to 10 to a rail car. These have been replaced by those cars that are the automobiles that are actually being sold by much smaller cars that load 15 to 18 to a rail car when they're being moved to market. So if we assume that the green initiative is a real issue that we are going to be facing going forward, it becomes very likely that we will never see, or it will be a long time before we will see enough car loadings in the light truck area to really boost up the total car loadings for the rail industry, and that some of these car loads, as the industry changes, as the automotive industry changes, may never come back, even if automotive production is resumed at former levels. Now, another area that has had a big impact on our business and will continue to as the recession recovers is the U.S. dollar exchange rate. When the exchange rate is low, when the U.S. dollar is low versus foreign countries, it is an export opportunity for a lot of production in the U.S. And just in two areas, first of all, our grain business, we could see that as the exchange rate improved in late 2008, you had two effects. One was the U.S. products getting more expensive abroad, and so less demand from that area. And then in addition to that, foreign economies having less cash to spend on U.S. goods. So the net effect was a fairly dramatic drop from about 24,000 carloads weekly down to about 16,000 carloads weekly of grain moving to market. The recession, incidentally, seems to have had very little impact, as you would expect, on the domestic market for grain, simply because, obviously, people will still be eating. But the export market has gotten dramatically smaller for U.S. grains. Likewise for U.S. coal, it had been being exported, both metallurgical and utility coal, moving offshore from particularly U.S. ports. That dropped dramatically towards the end of 2008 as the dollar began to have far more value versus offshore currency. Net result is that we're seeing a recession in which their car loadings and intermodal taken together are running about 18% below where they were a year ago. Now, do we see a bottom? Possibly. This 18% level has been reasonably stable now. It's run between about 17% and 20% for a fair number of weeks to this point. So, are we confident we're at the bottom? No. Are we anticipating that maybe we have found the bottom? Perhaps at this point, it's looking more and more like that. So how long this bottom will last, we're not sure. But we do know that to recover, and looking at past recoveries, it will not be a quick process to get back up to, say, 2006 levels, simply because it will take time for the economy to regenerate itself. It will take time for the various stimulus projects to become a part of the economy. That's becoming very clear. So we are not looking forward to a rapid recovery at this point in time. Now, the other kicker that has been in our business is that there's clearly been some real volatility in fuel prices, leading to some interesting cost management issues over the past several years. The spike last summer, certainly a serious cost management issue. The one thing that we are happy with is at least that the price is down where they are today. It is a little bit easier to manage this one element of cost and volatility than it was a year ago. So what's the state of the industry? Well, as I said, year to date, things are off on average about 18%. That puts about 500,000 freight cars, both those owned by railroads and by private companies, almost a third of the total, into storage, along with about 5,000 locomotives. And in fact, some locomotives are coming off the assembly line at this point in time, going directly into storage rather than putting revenue miles on immediately. At the same time, about 17,000 employees, about 10% of the workforce, is on furlough. The interesting thing, though, is that because the industry entered the recession in good good financial condition, that it is still making the infrastructure investments, the infrastructure improvements that were ongoing before in 2008 and earlier, to the extent that 2009 will end up being about the third largest year for infrastructure investment in rail history. Those projects, most of the projects are ongoing. In some cases, time frames for completion have been extended slightly, in some cases significantly, but for the most part, the infrastructure projects that were moving forward in the industry prior to 2009 are still ongoing. Another reason for keeping them going, since the cash is available to do so, is that they are significantly cheaper to implement this year than they were a year ago, and certainly better than 2 years ago. So, what's the summary? We don't know. Certainly the forecast for economic recovery can take you anywhere from late 2011 for a full recovery to late 2013. And where that will fit, we don't know. Are there some commodities that we watch that seem to be indicators of where that might be? There are, one in particular is plastic pellets moving, since it is such a foundation product for so many things in the economy, and tends to move before many other things would in our recovery process. So far, we have seen no upticks that would indicate that we're at the end of the recession itself. But as I say, the one bright point is that there is at least some indication that we may be moving along the bottom of the economic process. With that, I'd like to go ahead and end it, and Laura, hand it back to you for any questions.